Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Hi, welcome to another episode of Unstoppable Mindset. And today we have, I think, a person who's pretty unstoppable. At least I tend to think so. He can make his own comments and judgment about that. But I'd like you all to meet David Schaefer. David is a blind civil rights attorney, has lots of stories to tell, I'm sure, about all of that. And I think has a lot of interesting things that will inspire all of us, but also a lot of things to make us think. David, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Welcome. Yeah, thanks for the great introduction. I'm happy to be on here and look forward to discussing issues involving accessibility and adjustment to blindness.
Well, let's see what we can do. So you were not blind when you first were growing up, as I understand it.
That's right. I always had horrible vision and was tremendously nearsighted. But until I got to about in my late 40s, I could still get by with glasses or hard contact lenses. That was about the time that I got glaucoma, and the glaucoma went undiagnosed for about a year due to some idiosyncrasies in my eye, which misread eye pressure on a standard test. And so by the time I went to a specialist to figure out that I had glaucoma, even though the pressure test didn't show it, I was gone. I was legally blind. My vision's about 2800, it's the closest that they can measure it. But I still see some. I can see shapes and things, and it depends a lot on light and various issues. But I'm pretty much reliant upon my cane and my technology these days to practice law.
So you sort of had to go through an adjustment process, obviously, about becoming blind and being blind and acknowledging that. How did all that go? What kind of training did you have? Or when did you decide that you really didn't see like you used to see?
I realized that after I totaled two cars, that kind of was the wake-up solution for me. It started off with severe night blindness. And so, they tried to accommodate me by letting me get home at 3 in the winter, get home before dark. Well, I could still drive, but it quickly ended up to the point where I couldn't see the drive. I couldn't much see across the street. That was a tough adjustment because I was in the middle of practicing law at the time. I was a assistant general counsel at the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. I just finished up a huge ADA class action, kind of reforming the agency's paratransit system. And then I started realizing that I couldn't see my notes anymore, that I couldn't see the face of witnesses on the witness stand, and suddenly litigation, which was my primary focus, became extremely difficult, if not impossible. It was very difficult because my employer had no idea how to adjust to somebody who was blind, since there was only one other blind person in our organization, and she had a totally different role. So it was a mismatched series of attempts to accommodate me that pretty much all failed. They started out with magnifiers and Zoom text and all that, but it finally became evident that I needed to learn to use the screen readers properly and not try to just magnify things 20 times and get by. That was very challenging because I was trying to keep up the practice of law at the same time while no longer being able to see what I was doing. Fortunately, I finally, through Columbia Lighthouse the Blind, got hooked up with Virginia's rehab agency, and they gave me initial, you know, training, JAWS and things like that, O&M, basic survival. But the problem is that these state agencies are so low on funding that I was expected to practice law with a total of 6 hours of JAWS training. And that's all that they would allocate to me. Obviously, that was not adequate to become proficient enough to practice law. I could barely read a website or a document. So I had to go out and get my own training and pay for it myself. And I still do to this day, due to the lack of resources that Virginia had. I understand it's much better in Maryland where I live now, but now that I've taught myself and paid for my own lessons, and I'm a pretty advanced JAWS user and tester. So what happened next was I began a campaign at Metro to make their technology accessible. Because once I learned to use JAWS, I realized I couldn't use their website because the public website wasn't accessible. I couldn't look up things for people on the phone. I couldn't use our intranet at all. I couldn't even do my own timesheets anymore because none of that was accessible. And that was a big problem because we struggled over that. The organization's initial reaction was, oh, we're not covered by 508 because we're not part of the federal government, despite the fact they were a federal contractor and therefore required to comply with 508 anyway. So after 4 years of fighting and complaining, I finally got them to adopt an accessibility policy. They made me the Section 508 officer. And then again, I taught myself accessibility. I taught myself web accessibility through DeQ University Online, enough so that I could start guiding the team that made up the website on how to make it accessible. So that was kind of how this all developed, that I went from zero competence to now being a fairly recognized web tester and user of this technology.
Well, let's go back a little bit. So you have been in law all your life. What got you into that? Why did you decide to choose law in the first place? Because obviously you didn't have some of the same causes that you do now, like blindness and accessibility and so on.
Well, I grew up in a town of 1,000 people in Ohio. My stepfather was a lawyer. He'd been a former state senator and majority leader of the Ohio Senate. So he was, of course, the only lawyer in town and the only lawyer for a while around nearby. But I saw how he helped people from anything from a divorce to a car accident to a TWI to a criminal offense to any sort of estate planning. I mean, he did everything. Clients are constantly coming to our house in the evening, and not just to his office. And it was just like part of our life. This is what we do. We help people with legal problems. I remember I was so curious about the law that he had a decent law library in the house. And so if I would ask him a legal question at 12 years old, he'd make me go into his office and look it up in American jurisprudence or Ohio jurisprudence, bring him back the answer, and then we'd discuss it. So I was doing legal research from 12 years old onward. And I guess I just got hooked up with it, plus the political angle of it, because we were all very active in politics. And my stepfather ran the campaigns for the Democratic congressman in our district and things like that. So politics and law was kind of in my blood from very early on.
Well, clearly you had a good teacher, because he made you go do the research and the work. And of course, there's nothing like discovering things for yourself. But you've had other good teachers, haven't you?
I have. When I was at the law school at Stanford, I had an interesting teacher, former Justice Scalia for con law. That was a fascinating experience and frustrating, but boy, did I learn his side of the law and his points of view and his philosophy. And the rest of that, I have the con law itself, I learned on my own, but we had to listen to his philosophies quite a bit. But he was a very good teacher. And then after I graduated from Stanford, I was lucky enough to clerk for an incredible woman on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a Carter appointee, who was also tremendously liberal and taught me more in that year than I'd learned in 3 years of law school. And so throughout, I guess, my career, I've been lucky to have mentors. After the clerkship, I went to Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in California, a large law firm, and had a litigation partner there kind of take me under his wing and let me go out. And my first week, I was in court, my first week on the job. Throughout your life, you've got to take advantage of mentors and people that really are looking out for you and that you can learn from. It's really the most valuable way to learn than trying to do everything on your own, as I learned when I lost my vision. It would have been really nice to have a lot of training fast rather than having to take a year to get up to speed on the technology.
Yeah, I mean, we all have to take things as they come. I remember in my involvement with the law from a legal standpoint comes from the other side, being a consumer. And I had a situation that happened, I think, in 1981. It was 80 or 81. I think it was 81. But I was denied access to an aircraft with my guide dog.
Wow.
And they insisted that I had to sit in the front seat, even though the airline's policy didn't require that. But we went to court with it. And eventually it was appealed and it went to the Ninth Circuit. We had a judge in LA, Francis Whalen. I don't know whether you ever encountered him.
Yeah.
He was a pretty old fellow.
Uh-huh.
But that was my closest experience to dealing with the appellate court directly. I've been involved and seen other appellate cases, but
yeah,
it was interesting.
How'd it come out?
The case was settled. It actually had to go back for a second trial because Francis Whalen was on the ninth, actually not the appellate court. He was in the Ninth Circuit, but when it went to appellate court, he didn't like it, but the appellate court found that he had erred and it went back for a second trial and we ended up settling it, which is unfortunate because it was certainly a case that could have been a little bit more of a landmark than it was, but it was interesting. One of the things that happened at the beginning of the case was that when the ruling, when motions were being heard at the beginning, one of the motions that the airline's lawyer put out was, well, yeah, it's our policy that people don't have to sit in the front row with their guide dog, but that's just our policy, and so it shouldn't be allowed in as evidence. And the judge allowed that, which was kind of strange.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all face those kinds of things. But Judge Whalen did what he did, and then it went to appellate court, and it did get settled. And, of course, over time, the law changed. It was a growth time for all of us. The Air Carrier Access Act was passed in 1986, and it needs to be strengthened. And then, of course, in 1991, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, which you have, obviously, as a lawyer now, a lot of involvement with. When you were going through training, well, let me put it this way. When you were becoming blind and discovering you were blind, how did all of that affect you in terms of your practice of law and your view about what you were going to do with the law and how you would do it?
Well, it seriously affected my ability to practice law for about a year. And it was a good thing. I was with a government agency because they couldn't get rid of me too easily with the disability. After that, it really made me... I've been doing ADA law since before the ADA, since I started practicing in California under the UNRRA Act. But it really hit home to me, this whole field of digital accessibility. I mean, of course, I knew about it, but I'd never had any cases on it in my entire practice until these days. So what I ended up doing was, first off, they switched me to internal advice from litigation. And one of the departments they gave me was ADA, in addition to human resources, because I'd spent my previous 20 years as a labor and employment lawyer advising large corporations. So doing that, let me start trying to make some impact from within those organizations. So to get ADA office and the human relations office to understand accessibility. And that was the first step, was an education. And it really is something that had to go on person by person, one at a time, because just talking about it, it never made an impression until I brought somebody in my office and showed them how I use JAWS, how a screen reader works, and how it doesn't work when something's not accessible. And the minute you give them a visual and hearing example of how important this is to a blind person, you've converted them. Okay, obviously we need to make this work for you because that's our obligation. But it's a person-by-person thing. Then they take it back, and the other people don't understand it. So then they got to come down to my office and get shown. And so I did a lot of internal training and advocacy and forced them to, you know, form the position of Section 508 officer, which I then was given along with my other jobs, and make a commitment to accessibility, company-wide and to the public and within. And that was a long battle, but I did it from within instead of without. Probably would have been quicker if I'd just turned around and sued them, but lawyers generally don't like to sue on behalf of themselves. It's not pleasant. So I worked from within and made changes. And left when I left that organization, their website was 95% AA 2.1 compliant. And that was due to 4 years of work by me manually with the web department. I had three people there working for 4 years to fix a 15,000 page website manually Of course, we used software or level access at the time, but there's others out there that are equally as good. But that just goes to show how difficult accessibility can be when you start from ground zero. And part of the thing that I'm into, as well as representing people with disabilities and advocating on behalf of people with disabilities and trying to make the ADA stronger in Congress, working with Congress on various issues to educate them. And now I'm finding that as I talk to people in Congress and the staff members, again, it's an education thing. Once you've shown them an example and explained how important accessibility is to 20% of their constituents who have disabilities, then it clicks and then they're interested. But it's really got to be a strong education effort by the blind community. And we have to reach out and explain ourselves to others and not feel embarrassed about being blind, but show them what we can do when we're blind if we have the right technology. And I think that demonstrating on a daily basis that you can do the same job as anybody else can do, with as long as you got the right technology and an accessible a source to read it from, you're just the same as anybody else. And I think that's the education effort that the blind community really needs to work harder on, because you got to change people's minds about this, and they can't view accessibility as simply an expense that's mandated by law.
Do you think it's all about technology? Do you think that the technology?
No, it's not. I mean, obviously, I deal with more than just digital accessibility. You know, I was also responsible for the physical accessibility of the buses, trains, and stations, and so forth. But it's an overall understanding of the concept of accessibility to the 20% of the population who has some sort of disability. And that's the hard part. To showing them, okay, well, they think, oh, there's only, 3 to 5% of the people that are blind that need a screen reader. They're not that important to me. What about the other 15% with other disabilities? You know, almost 40% of which are cognitive. Those people are totally being left out of the world. They're being left out of jobs. They're being left out of information technology. And, the studies show that people with IDD issues often make up the most best and loyal and valuable employees. Study after study has shown that if we simply know how to accommodate them. And that's not so easy as it is to fix a website to make it 508 or WCAG compliant. That's much more, even more of an education effort. I would say the other project that I'm working on is also for all people with disabilities, and that I'm working with a company called Waymap, a UK company, and a partnership with Verizon. And we're mapping the whole DC metro and DC metropolitan area for the blind with step-by-step navigation. That process also has separate options for people using wheelchairs. And I was the major drafter of the US standards for this technology, as well as 1.1, which is the standards for cognitive wayfinding, which will be the next phase. So there is technology out there to help people with disabilities other than just blindness. And it's in its infancy, but some very good pilots have been done with FTA, with whom I work quite a bit, Federal Transit Administration, that we can make much more of the world accessible to people, not only who are blind, but with other types of disabilities that make it difficult for them to navigate or to use technology.
So the way we met was actually through, as you know, Accessibility, where does that fit into what is happening to make the whole internet and website access available?
Well, what it's going to help do is guide people to accessible locations. If your website's accessible, then we can put you on to this app and people can find you, and not only find you, but read the menu in your restaurant. And so can tourists find you. So by encouraging people, you know, by expanding this project into convention centers, into other places, or museums, galleries, where there's a ton of information, we can integrate the accessibility of the web, the original website, to, for example, the descriptions on a picture in the National Gallery, to be, you know, read to you and explained. And all of that is going to be, you know, 100% WCAG compliant. So these are, I think, these all work together in my various projects to show people that there's an overall issue of accessibility. Websites, of course, are one of the major ones, but we've got to integrate this awareness concept with not just websites, but with how do we make this world safe and accommodating for all people with disabilities so that everybody can achieve their full potential.
So I know that you also, in addition to doing the WayMap project, though, do or have become involved with Accessibe specifically, so website access in general, but Accessibe in specific. Why did you choose Accessibe to work with?
Well, that's another interesting story. When I was the 508 officer at Metro, I was deep into manual coding, fixing, you know, analysis of these reports, and how to deal with them. And that's why it took 4 years to get that website compliant. And that was 4 years of daily work by a team of people. I was against layered approaches at first. Some of the ones that have been proposed to us at Metro simply didn't work. So I just figured, okay, I'm not interested in layered approaches. When somebody gives me something and it doesn't even work on their own website, then, you know, forget it. But, you know, I was introduced to Accessibe with some skepticism, and then I started trying it and testing it. And I found that it made websites accessible and usable to really the greatest extent feasible by AI technology. So I was convinced that Accessibe is better than the other ones. Plus, what really impressed me most about Accessibe is the fact it's not just for the blind. And it has significant settings for cognitive disorders, AHD, seizure disorders, various types of color vision issues, and cognitive. And I think that this is the comprehensive approach that I've been preaching, that we need to accommodate all disabilities. We can't just focus on the blind community. We can't just focus on the deaf community or the IDD community. This has got to be an overall attitude about how we approach all of our technology, how we approach shopping, how we approach going into a store, getting down the street, getting on a train or bus, that we've got to bring together these concepts of universal design for everybody so that the entire population has the same opportunity as everybody else.
Do you think Accessibe is having success in this arena?
Yeah, I do. And we continue to outreach to the blind community to talk to us and give input. I give both legal and technical input to Accessibe. And I think that's because I can see both sides of this. I can see how the courts are developing the law, as well as how the technology is developing and how it's being used. And it's a fascinating place to be. And I'm, enjoying working with them quite a bit as we try to bring more education and accessibility to the 20% of the population that's left out these days.
It's interesting the society and the times that we live in. We are in such a technological era, yet more and more we see everything being oriented, or most things being oriented toward a visual process. So websites, for example, that put more visual stuff in. And what prompts me to mention that is we were watching, my wife and I were watching a commercial this morning on a television, and it was just some people singing a song, and there was nothing to say that it was Google talking about all the ways that it protects us. And there are a lot of those kinds of commercials that do nothing but play music or sounds, but that have nothing to do with anything. How do we get people to recognize that they are leaving out a significant amount of the population? And oh, by the way, what about the person who gets up? I guess the marketing people don't think that that will be a big problem, and I'll come back to it, but don't think that'll be a big problem because they'll saturate the air with the commercial, so eventually people will see it, but they don't even deal with the people who get up during a commercial and go do something else, get a snack or whatever, who never see it.
I don't understand it either myself. As many times I turn to my significant other and I say, "What was that commercial about? I like the music." Because I don't know what they're trying to sell. I don't know why they think this is useful. Especially, like you said, that half the people get up and go to the bathroom on commercials. That's why all the toilets flush at once. But yeah, I don't get it. It's just like they think, oh, this has impact, to flash a big name at the end after the beautiful pictures. Doesn't have any impact on me. So they're losing 5% of their potential customer base. Do they
But they may
care?
be losing more because, again, anyone who doesn't see the commercial, blind or not, has the same challenge.
And this is the fault of the people that look only at the visual side of things, and that's all they can think or think about. These people that are creating the commercials, people that are creating websites, whatever creative people are doing this, they're looking at it and they're deriving their impact from what they see and not what they hear. And it frustrates me, but I figure, okay, well, I'll never buy that product since I can't tell what they're advertising. So that's one down the drain. They won't get my business. What else can you do except deprive them of their business if they're not going to make this their commercial accessible?
How do we break into their psyche and get them to recognize what they're doing? Which is, of course, a general question that deals with the whole visual or non-disability aspect of society in general. How do we get the public at large, the politicians, the visible people at large, to bring us into the conversation? Maybe a good way to start that is, why aren't we part of the conversation?
I think we're not because we're not thrusting ourselves into it. We can't just sit back and wait for these people to call us up and say, "Hey, we were just thinking about whether blind people could see our commercials. Got any advice?" No, we have to get out to, like we're doing with Congress, get out to them and explain to them what we're seeing or not seeing. We need to get to the advertising community with some sort of education if they really are interested in selling us products. So the blind, I mean, we're talking 24 million people in the United States. That's a tremendous market. We just need to get people to understand that they're losing 24 million potential customers. every time they put an ad up like that.
But in general, whether we deal with the advertisement part of it or whatever, we deal with the whole population of persons with disabilities. How do we get into the psyche of people, into the conversation? I mean, I hear what you're saying about getting Congress and showing Congress what we do, but here's a perfect example of the problem. Several years ago, I went to a congressman who I knew to talk about the fact that at that time, and still, as part of the Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act, it is possible for organizations and agencies to apply for an exemption so they do not have to pay a person with a disability a minimum wage who they bring in. And that typically is in the case of some sheltered workshops, that number has diminished a great deal because there's been visibility, but it's still there. And the law is still there. And what this congressman said is, well, we're opposed to minimum wage in general. And so I can't possibly support this bill. Had nothing to do with the fact that it's still the law of the land, but we're not considered an important, and I mean all persons with disabilities, we still are not really considered part of society in the same way. Now, we're not hated like some people probably hate different races, and we certainly don't face some of the challenges that women do, although blind women probably do. But the bottom line is, we as a collective group, and not just blind women, but women with disabilities, but we are as a total group, not included really in the conversation. We see it all the time. Last year's presidential elections are a perfect example. But you can go anywhere and cite anything that looks at all of the different things that go on. COVID websites were not accessible last year. So, you know, how do we get into that conversation collectively?
Well, that is how we do it, is collectively. I mean, what I think we're doing too much of is that, you know, you've got the blind community advocating for this. You've got the people with physical disabilities advocating for their thing. You've got the people with cognitive advocating for those things. And they're all just focusing on what they need. What we all need to be focusing on together is what we need as a group of people with disabilities. Now, granted, each type of disability has different needs, but if we can get everybody to understand just the concept of universal design and start applying that to everything we build, to from buildings to websites to whatever, then we'll be including this population. But even the phrase universal design is not even fully widely understood. But that is where we have to be going, and we have to be doing it as the entire disability community. That is numbers, lots of numbers of people.
Sure. Since 20% to 25% of all persons in the United States have a disability, that's a pretty large group. And it's a group.
You're only talking about 100 million people.
Yeah. And you're talking about a minority second only to, depending on who you want to listen to, men or women. Probably there are more women than men, so men may be the minority, although they don't think so. But the bottom line is, it's a very large group of people.
Well, it's the most significant, you know, it's the most significantly sized protected group there is under the law.
But the protections aren't always there. So, for example,
that's the other problem.
That's the other problem.
Which is the courts. The courts are slow to catch up too. The courts don't understand this. You file a web accessibility lawsuit in front of your typical federal district judge. I mean, they don't have a clue what this case is about. And then we're down to the battle of competing experts, you know, and where does that put a judge? Where does that put a jury? I mean, the legal system is not the right place to be solving this problem. Unfortunately, it's the only place we have left to go to.
Well, I guess that's, of course, part of the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, no, Go ahead.
Well, that's of course part of the problem, but you know, is it the only place to go to? So for example, you wrote an article earlier this year, which I found to be very interesting and very informative, that talked about web accessibility. And that article described a lot of the issues, a lot of what's being done. And maybe you want to talk a little bit about that and where people can see it, but also should we work to be finding more people who will publicize in the world part of the issues that we have? When I talked about being part of the conversation, frankly, I think we need to be putting out more more writings, more articles, more missives, more whatever. And as you said, we need to be putting ourselves in the conversation.
We do. And, you know, I listen mostly to NPR. And what I do notice there is they do a lot of stories on disability issues. I'm really impressed by the way they cover disabilities. Mm-hmm. I don't see that on mainstream media. Occasionally you'll have a feel good story on the evening news, depending on which one you're watching. You know, they tag at the end for the last 2 minutes. But really dealing with this as a societal issue, it's so low on the priority of things these days after COVID and overseas wars and foreign policy and everything else that's going on. We're just faded. We fade into the background. We're unnoticed. I mean, it's just like when you walk into a store with somebody who's with you, they will talk to the other person and ask them, what does he want to order? Instead of asking you. We're invisible.
Yeah. And of course, also part of the problem today is that with everything that's going on, we face it too, and it kind of beats you down.
It does. It's depressing. I mean, my usual answer is I can order for myself, in that sort of tone. But you know, it's like when you walked into a doctor's office the other day with my white cane, trying to find my way because they don't allow visitors now, so that I can't bring anybody with me to guide me. So I'm, you know, stumbling around the place trying to find the front desk and all that. And then they shove a piece of paper in front of me saying, can you please sign in? And they've seen me walking around that reception area trying to find the reception desk with a white cane. And they turn around and ask me to sign something. They don't get it.
It's all education. And I think something you said much earlier is very important. We have to, as hard as it is, as frustrating as it is, as trying as it is on our patients sometimes, we have to be teachers. We have to help. Yes. But we do need to speak out. We do need to be pushing ourselves in the conversation. There's a lot of mainstream media that, as you said, doesn't cover us much. And somehow we need to get more people to reach out to mainstream media saying, why aren't you talking about the fact that blind people and other persons with disabilities are exempt in some situations from receiving minimum wage? Why aren't you talking more about the lack of appropriate information provided to us? Why aren't you talking about the fact that when one flies on an airplane, the flight attendants don't necessarily give us the same information that people who can see or people who can read don't have, already have. And I'm like referring to the fact that people like with dyslexia also have issues.
Yeah, well, pointing to the emergency exits doesn't help a lot.
Right, exactly. but you know, it would be so simple for flight attendants to say, when they're doing their pre-flight briefing, emergency exits are located at overwing exits are located at rows X and Y.
Well, that's like assuming row 13 there's a and row 14. Number you can That's assuming there's a road number that you can read with your fingers.
Well, except when you are when you go on, you know what seat you're at, so you know what row you're in. So
yeah, you can count.
Yeah, but if, you can count. Yeah, they could do something to make the row numbers also more accessible. But again, you do know what seat you go to, and if you know that, then you can easily count and get at least a much better sense than what you do. I heard once somebody explain that when the pre-flight briefings are being given, what flight attendants are trained to do, and I don't know if it's true, but it could be, what flight attendants are trained to do is to look to see who's really paying attention to the briefings, because those are the people that they may be able to call on to help if there really is an emergency, because they're the ones that tend to be collecting the information.
Right.
Don't know if that's really true, but it certainly makes sense.
Yeah.
And it is also something that more of us should do, and more of us should be demanding that they do the appropriate things to provide the access that we need to be able to pay attention.
Yeah, you know, Michael, it's such an overwhelmingly huge job. I mean, we're talking about everything from websites to, we haven't even talked about apps on phones, to physical accessibility, to how you're treated in a doctor's office or an airplane or at a restaurant, or I mean, it's all throughout society that the people with disabilities face these obstacles. And of course, you know, I think websites are a fantastic place to start, but that's not the end of the accessibility discussion. That we need to have much broader discussions about that, and we need to be doing it more publicly.
Right, and I think we can. I don't think that we need to always use civil disobedience as our solution, although there certainly have been times in the past when that has been what people feel that they need to do, and it can be successful, but it still ultimately is about education.
Mm-hmm.
And if people refuse to listen, then obviously there are other actions that need to be taken. You mentioned what happened with you with Metro, and Metro at least was interested in working with you and allowing you to help them fix their website issue. By the way, how is it now?
Oh, it's pretty good. They brought in consultants to do the remainder of the remediation that I wasn't able to finish. So they're trying to get as close to 100% compliant as possible.
And obviously that's pretty important to do. I don't know whether Accessibe is a part of that, or whether, you know, have they used Accessibe in any way? I'm just curious.
I don't know who the outside consultant's using right now, but they haven't seen Accessibe put on the site yet. I know they use Accessibe's testing tool.
Right. And can you tell us about that, the testing tool?
Accessibe has a very quick and free testing tool, which is one of the better ones out there on the market, including some of the ones you pay tens of thousands of dollars for. And if you go to ace.accessibility.com, it's really simple. You just plug in the website name, you hit get a report, you get an immediate report within like 10 seconds of all the errors. It rates it from compliant to semi-compliant to non-compliant. And then you can email yourself the report in a PDF form and read all the details about what the issues are on the website. You know, in some of my own personal battles I've had recently with our county government, trying to force them to provide me with accessible materials as required by federal law, you know, I finally just sent them a report of their website. Our entire county website is non-compliant, and they said they know it. that baffled me. And but they're getting me my documents on their threat of a federal lawsuit.
It's amazing. I recently upgraded. We were talking about it before we started this. I also upgraded to Windows 11. And there are some real challenges from an access standpoint. For example, and I'm saying this after having called and spoken to Microsoft's Disabilities Answer Desk, I needed to map a network drive. And the instructions say, click on the three dots on the toolbar.
Mm-hmm.
The three dots. So that's inaccessible to me. I'm going to try some other experiments to see if I can access them. But in Windows 10, there were ways to do it. Why would they, and could they, and should they have updated to a new version of Windows without dealing with the access issues? And I know what they're going to say. They did it with Microsoft Edge years ago when Microsoft Edge came out. They knew it wasn't accessible. And they said, well, we'll get to it. Well, you know, that's immediately sending the message that some of us are not as important as everyone else.
They are. And I'm so sorry I upgraded to Windows 11. I would never recommend it to any visually impaired person right now until they get it fixed. It makes your life so much more difficult.
Well, but it's going to take a while to happen. And the problem is that more and more things will become unsupported. So upgrading needs to be done, but there should be a real outcry to Microsoft from a large number of people about the inaccessibility issues that they face in Windows 11.
Yeah.
And that is something that gets back to what we discussed earlier. Microsoft should have made it accessible right from the outset, right out of the gate.
Right.
And they have the team. They have the people. They have the knowledge. It's a priority.
Well, the priority for them is to get the product out the door and then worry about, you know, the details later.
But still, the priority is to get the product out the door so as many people can sort of use it as possible, and the people who are marginalized, well, we'll get to them eventually.
Yeah, right.
Which is a problem. If people want to read your article, how can they do that?
It's on my website, davidschaferlaw.com, under the ADA tab.
Schaefer is spelled?
S-H-A-F-F-E-R.
So davidschaferlaw.com under the ADA tab.
Right.
So what's next for you? Where do you go from here?
Well, I'm also been retained by another organization to do some congressional lobbying on behalf of the ADA, making the ADA explicitly include websites, and also to work with them to make Congress itself accessible. Working with the House, with the Congressional Select Committee on Modernization. And, you know, you got to start somewhere. Your Congress has got to set the example for the country. And it's really pathetic that the studies I've shown are that approximately 80 or 90% of congressional websites are inaccessible. Mm-hmm. And we're their constituents too. And we have an equal right to communicate with our representatives under the First Amendment as anybody else, and we're being deprived of it. And I think it's a serious issue for Congress that they've got to face, that they're not making themselves available to the entire population they're supposed to serve.
Good point. And hopefully you'll be able to make some progress in that. We certainly want to hear from you as to how that's going, and you are welcome to come back here anytime and tell us what's happening and keep us all up to date. We really appreciate your time today in sitting down with us and talking about a lot of these issues. Are there any kind of last minute things that you'd like to say?
I just want to be treated the same as everybody else. And I think that's what all of us want. You know, you treat me like you would anybody else with courtesy. And if it's an older person, you're courteous to them in a different way than you are a blind person or a deaf person. Just, I'd like to see people treat people as people and not according to what they look like or are able to do or hear, see, or think.
Well, clearly that's a goal I think that all of us share. And I hope that we'll be able to see more of that happen. Excuse me. I know being involved with Accessibility, it's an Accessibility goal. And I'm glad that Accessibility is really growing in its understanding of the issues and that it intends to do more to try to do what it can to educate people in society about all of this. Of course, that's part of what this podcast is about.
Right. And I think we're well on our way there. We have more work to do, but we've made a lot of progress since I came on board in, I think, February. And I think you came on board just a little bit before that.
Right.
So we've done a lot this year, and next year it's going to be even better.
Well, I hope people have enjoyed listening to this and that they've learned something. We are always interested in hearing from listeners. You are welcome to reach out to me directly at michaelhi@accessibility.com. Accessibility is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. So michaelhi@accessibility.com. David, if you want people to be able to contact you, how do they do that?
David.Schaefer@davidschaeferlaw.com.
It's as easy as it gets.
Yeah, I try to make things easy.
Yeah, that's absolutely so. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We've been working to get this set up for a while. You've had a pretty busy schedule, and so yeah. We're able to do it. But seriously, we'd like to keep hearing from you as to what progress you're making and your thoughts. So don't hesitate to reach out and let us know if you'd like to come back on, and we will chat some more. And in the meanwhile, again, if people want to reach out, you can reach me at Michael Hinkson, that is michaelhi@accessibility.com. And if you would like to consider being a guest on our podcast because you have some things to say, email me and we'll see what we can do. I want to thank you all for joining us on another edition of Unstoppable Mindset. And David, thank you as well for doing that.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibility, and is sponsored by Accessibility. Please visit www.accessibility.com. Accessibility is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.